Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Tonight, I'm proud to bring you Living Hellenismos, which is part of our Light of Olympus series, broadcasting from our Athenaeum. And here is Tony Merzwicki, the host. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing great, and I'm looking forward to hearing about your latest blogs. I looked at the celebrity blog. I'm not very much into what celebrities are doing, so it didn't resonate with me, but I understand it's resonated with lots of people.
Indeed it has. But before we get into it, I just wanted to mention that this has been a month like no other month. I mean, you look at what happened on January the 6th with insurrectionists breaching the Capitol building, entering holy space, the center of American democracy, breaching it, smearing feces and urine on the walls, just desecrating the place, calling for the execution of Mike Pence and Senator Pelosi. It's been absolutely horrific. And then we were supposed to get more on the 17th with marches on all 50 state capitals. And then there was going to be another protest on the 20th. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes. There were lots of people doing workings, praying for safety, making sure that President-elect Biden was kept safe, along with Kamala Harris, and praying for a peaceful transition of power. And in the end, that actually did happen. So, but it was a roller coaster ride.
It was a hell of a roller coaster ride. And you're right. Many people, regardless of which pantheons or deities they happen to be attuned to, were united in praying, sending energy, visualizing, doing rituals, performing services. So each person who wanted a peaceful outcome gave everything they could to the situation. And I'm glad that it did turn out that way.
Absolutely. I mean, the worst case scenario was civil war. And there were some white supremacist organizations who were actively pursuing that end. And none of us want that. We may not all get on. We may not agree on everything. But at the end of the day, I think most people want peace. They want to have a decent life. They want to have food on the table. They want to be able to pay their bills. I think there's far more uniting us than there is dividing us.
I think so, too.
You mentioned my celebrity witch blog, and the reason why I wanted to write it was what actually happened was that Taylor Swift, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her, she's a very popular singer at the moment. Also, she has a huge Twitter presence. When former President Trump was on Twitter, he had 80.5 million Twitter followers. This is going back to a few months. Actually, no, it was almost a year ago, May the 20th last year. So President Trump had 80.5 million Twitter followers, whereas Taylor Swift had 86.1 million followers. So basically, as soon as she tweets something, it goes out to 86 million people. She has more of an impact than President Trump did. So the point was that she got a single out, And a number of people came to the conclusion that she was practicing witchcraft. And so there was negativity on coming from some people in the pagan and witch communities. They felt that she wasn't qualified to take a voice on witchcraft. She felt that she, they felt that she hadn't gone through the same initiatic processes that they did. So there was a little bit of negativity towards her. My attitude is that witchcraft has had so much bad press over the last 2,000 years that mm-hmm. if we can get good press from someone like Taylor Swift, it has to be a good thing. And something very similar happened almost 4 years ago. There was a binding spell directed at former President Trump. And Lana Del Rey, who is another well-known singer, publicly announced that she was going to be taking part in the binding spell. So the point is that she's another person with a huge fanatical following. And there are a lot of people out there, mainly Christians, who have this incredibly negative attitude towards witches. They feel that they worship the devil, they do all sorts of horrible things. So to have someone who's a popular singer come out and say, well, I'm engaging in witchcraft, I think it's really cool, has to be a good thing. It gives us good publicity. Now, the flow-on effect from that is that as their millions of followers decide to have a go at witchcraft as well, for some it's going to be a curiosity, just something that they do for a laugh. But mm-hmm. others may well feel that this is something that they want to engage in full-time. And new blood has to come into the community from somewhere. On a similar note, there have been a number of Hollywood movies out about Greek mythology. So we've had, most notably, though, the Percy Jackson movies. And as you can imagine, there are a lot of Hellenic reconstructionists saying, well, this is nothing like the Greek legends. But the point is that they're not meant to be documentaries. They're Hollywood fantasy. So most people watch those movies and be entertained. But there'll be some who'll think, I wonder what all this Greek mythology stuff's all about. And they may well start engaging in a study of Greek mythology, possibly getting into Greek religion. And again, that's, like I said before, blood has to come from somewhere.
That's very true. In fact, I wrote a paper on that back in my college days, that mythology, as we look at it now, is a little skewed because it's always been part of the popular culture. It's always been part of entertainment. Homer was an entertainer, and so were the playwrights of ancient Athens. So yes, there were ritual aspects to the myths, and yes, there were diverse stories told about the gods and heroes, but they survived then as they survive now in our mass consciousness through entertainment. So I feel that the Percy Jackson movies and the other entertainment are how these tales manifest today and speak to us. And you're right, some people are entertained, and that's fine, and that's it. And some people say, I'd like to learn more, and then that opens a door to more serious study.
See, up until a few days ago, the standard education was a so-called classical education, where people would learn. They'd learn Latin, they'd learn Greek, and so they'd be studying Latin mythology, Greek mythology. They'd be extremely conversant in those sorts of things. And if you look at the artwork that we have, particularly Renaissance art, you'll see just how many of the Roman and Greek myths pervade through the arts of that era. People were incredibly conversant in it. And I think that it'd be true to say that people were as conversant with Greek and Roman myths as they were with the Bible. Whereas now we've moved away from a classical education. People are looking at more practical sort of courses. So there's less familiarity with the Greek myths. So I think that's important for Hollywood to produce stories to drag people in. And as we both agree, there'll be some people who'll be just entertained and think, okay, that was great. Next time for the next movie. But there'll be others who'll be left thinking, that was really cool. That resonated with me on a very deep level. I need to find out more. And they're the sort of people who are going to come into our community.
Right.
I think that's incredibly important.
I think so, too.
On a similar vein, I don't know if you remember a few years ago, a chain of stores called Sephora, who sell makeup and skincare products, they wanted to put out a starter witch kit. So that was going back to 2018, I believe, September 2018. They wanted to put out a starter witch kit, and it was going to be $42, and it had tarot cards, sage, and a rose crystal. So what happened was that there was a huge outcry from the witchcraft community, and they felt that this was disrespectful, and Sephora wound up pulling the plug on the whole thing because they were being accused of trivializing the religions of those who practice witchcraft. I actually think that was unfortunate that that was the outcome. Because the thing is that it seems to be coming from a place of poverty consciousness, that people have $42 to spend and that's it. So if they spend their $42 at Sephora, they're not going to have $42 to spend at the local esoteric store. But the point is, most people do not go to your local esoteric stores. So you've got thousands and thousands of people who go into Sephora, and they may well come across this witchcraft kit, and they'll think, oh, this looks interesting. And they will buy it on the spur of the moment. So for some, it will be just entertainment, and it won't lead to anything. But then there'll be others thinking, I'm actually really enjoying this. I'm enjoying playing with the tarot cards. I'm enjoying using the sage. I'm enjoying playing with my rose quartz crystal. And they may think, well, what happens next? So they go back to Sephora, and Sephora don't have anything else for them. So all of a sudden they're thinking, well, I need to go to some sort of specialty store. And that is when they'll go off to an esoteric-type store or a witchcraft-type store. So by they allowed those starter witch kits to be sold at Sephora, I think you would have had thousands and thousands of people buying up these kits. And out of those thousands, a few would then want to go on and embrace witchcraft in a very serious sort of way. I think they kind of shot themselves in the foot. I remember the first time I walked into an esoteric type store, I was a little bit apprehensive, not quite knowing what to expect. Coming from a Christian upbringing, you think that they could be engaging in all sorts of evil stuff. Obviously, once you go and you realize that all your fears are unfounded. I can imagine a lot of people be feeling roughly the same sort of way. So I think it's basically all advertising. By having stores selling witchcraft kits, you're then getting the word out to more people. By having celebrities saying that they openly embrace witchcraft, then encourages their followers to seek it out. And that all has to be a good thing, because for so many years, people have tied in witchcraft and devil worship, and they think of everything as being united. One of the problems that we have at the moment is the QAnon cult. And the QAnon cult posits this idea that there are these liberal and Hollywood elites who engage in Satan worship, and that they're pedophiles and they're harvesting the blood of the children that they're abusing for some sort of rejuvenating product. And for a lot of Christians, if someone's engaging in Satan worship, then there's no difference between that and witchcraft and possibly even worshiping the Hellenic gods. I mean, after all, Paul said that the gods of the pagans are demons.
Yes.
And I think And I think that a lot of Christians would take that very, very literally. So we really need to have people on our side, people saying that they work with the Greek gods. They're definitely not demons. I mean, we don't have a devil figure in our pantheon. And for as long as I've been in this game, I've been hearing, which is particularly Wiccans, saying that there is no Satan in their pantheon. They basically have a lord and a lady, and that's it. There's no room for a Satan figure. They don't worship the devil. They don't engage in any sort of nasty things. It's all about working with the wheel of the year, venerating nature, and being a nice and responsible person. We need good publicity.
That's a topic that it would take lots of hours to get into. And my opinion is closer to yours than in most people in the Hellenic community. You know, I don't believe that we're harmed by popular culture. You know, I welcome popular culture. I welcome Greek mythology toys and video games and movies and role-playing games, and devote a lot of time to talking about them because they're excellent ways to introduce yourself to the older myths, to the topic, and people don't take them religiously. You know, if you're playing a video game like God of War, you know, you're immersing yourself in the mythology, and you're not being insulting to any spirituality that's attached to it or disrespectful. And in fact, in the God of War, I think the gods are the bad guys. So,
yeah.
But again, it's a story, and you know, stories were told even in antiquity, as you pointed out, that the gods are the bad guys. So. I see these as explorations, creative explorations that allow people to ask questions and to view things in a certain way. And I think that that's healthy rather than being disrespectful to the spirituality.
Exactly. And myths have changed as time's gone on. You look at the very earliest writings, you look at the genealogies of the gods, you pair what Homer says with Hesiod. There are differences every once in a while. And then as you start to go forward through time, you look at the Roman writings where they do analyses of the various Greek myths, and you start to see even more differences cutting in. So where do you draw the line? Do you accept just the Greek myths, or do you then accept the Roman variations on the Greek myths as well? And if you accept those, why not accept some of the variations that we're having now? If a Hollywood producer decides to work with the Greek gods, I mean, at the end of the day, it is just entertainment. And I can't, unless you're engaging in chaos magic, you're not really going to be working with anything out of pop culture. Anyone who seriously gets into Hellenic Reconstructionism will be working with the ancient gods in as pure a form as possible. So they will wind up having to embrace the reality of those gods, read up on the myths of those gods, and probably work with the hymns pertaining to those gods. Personally, I'm a great fan of the Orphic hymns and the Homeric hymns. I like to use those whenever I can. I find them absolutely beautiful, and they resonate with me on a very deep level.
Yes. Truly so. I've worked with popular culture iterations of the Hellenic gods, demigods, and heroes, and I found that the experiences were, you know, very interesting and very powerful because there's a lot of energy into the forms that the gods take in, let's just take the Marvel comic book, for instance. And even though there are various variations of Hercules within the Marvel pantheon, because of the movies and because of the long history of comic books, there's a lot of energy in these tales. I would venture forth to say that the Marvel Hercules is a tulpa at this particular point in time, or a god form that's as valid as some of the ancient ones.
It's an egregor. And you actually have many more people getting into those particular god forms because of the prevalence of movie culture. Just going to share a little story with you. In the mid-90s, I used to go to meetings in Sydney called Pagans in the Pub, where you had a group of pagans getting together, and we'd have a bit of a chat. We would have something that we'd pass around that would act as a talking stick, and we'd pick various topics and discuss them. But one thing that I noticed is that some people turn up early, some people might be running a little bit late, but all of them would leave at the same time. And the reason was that at the time, Buffy was huge. Yeah. All these people, this pub was right next to Central Train Station, so all these pagans and witches would be rushing off trains to get in time to watch Buffy. Buffy was huge. And I have actually come across chaos magic workings where they invoke Buffy because she was so huge. So there is this energy associated with these egregores, or you call them torpors or god forms, that can be tapped into. And because you've got so many millions of people watching these shows and treating them as almost real, then there is a very tangible energy that you can tap into.
Yes, most certainly so. And again, just as powerful as using the ancient forms, a little bit different, but still, in a world that doesn't recognize the old forms as a valid foci for feelings of devotion, the characters in a comic book, and DC Comics has been really great in putting out every few years introduction to how mythology manifests in superhero books. And Marvel just came out with one recently as well to reinforce that. Before then, mm-hmm. there were books like Our Gods Wear Spandex, which kind of broached the topic and introduced it. But it's a very interesting way of experiencing the modern incarnations of these tales and the questions that they ask, which are, in essence, spiritual and psychological questions, are very valid.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, unless you're part of a magical group which is telling you how to practice your rituals, you have to find your own path. You have to find what resonates with you. I personally enjoy the ancient myths. I enjoy working with ancient hymns. I enjoy working with ancient spells taken from the Greek magical papyri. I love that feeling of ancientness that that I think has been lost in this day and age. But there are other people who resonate far more powerfully with more modern contemporary representations of the gods that they may find in the Marvel universe or they find in Hollywood movies. And if that's what works for them, if that's what makes them better people, then definitely go for it. It's not up to us to dictate how anyone should be practicing their spirituality. Everyone has to find their own path.
I knew when we had, when we lived in Pennsylvania, we had the Barbarian Bazaar, which included its own Athenaeum where we conducted metaphysical classes. One of the customers who later attended some of the classes, she had built her entire spirituality around Transylvania type game. I don't remember exactly what it was called, but now they've made animes of it. Castlevania, that's what it was called. And
Wow.
And one of the folks who published your Greco-Egyptian book, they had published a book on the magic of pop culture. And I had interviewed them on a show years ago. Elwood, I think his name was?
Taylor Elwood.
Yes. So that was a very interesting conversation, and he provided many insights on how and why someone could and would and should build their spirituality around a video game that speaks to them.
Taylor was very heavily into that sort of thing. He was actually the U.S. manager for Imanian Press, so he was actually my editor for when I put out Greco-Egyptian Magic. So I wound up meeting him at an event in Columbus, Ohio. We kind of clicked, and he asked me to send my manuscript to him, and he basically picked it up and ran with it. So I am incredibly grateful to him and also to Storm Constantine, God rest her soul. She died about a week ago, as you probably heard. She was the owner of Emanian Press. They gave me my first break. So I'm incredibly, incredibly grateful to them both. You know, because Taylor thought he's going to grab it, but obviously he'd have to run it past Storm. So I've communicated with both of them, maybe not extensively, but occasionally over the years. They're both very nice people. Taylor's doing his own thing now. He moved away from Emanian a couple of years ago, and I think he may have his own publishing house now. I'm not 100% sure on that, but you know, whatever Taylor gets into, he always does to the best of his abilities. He's a very competent young man, and I'm glad you had the opportunity to.
Yeah.
I'm glad you had the opportunity to interview him. Again, his approach is so totally different to mine. His first foray into writing was he was one of the three authors of a book on creating. I know his first book was on pop culture, but he was one of three authors for a book before that. And again, it was along the lines of pop culture, I think creating thought forms using pop culture. I can't remember exactly what it was, but again, that's been his thing over the last few years. So it's kind of chaos magic, as I understand it, tapping into this egregore that's been created by millions of people watching a particular character either in a movie or reading their exploits in comic books and tapping into them in a huge way. But it works for him. That's the important thing. We all have to find our path. His path isn't right for me, but it works incredibly well for him. Yeah. And just as my path works really well for me, but he'd sort of look at it and say, "That's interesting, dude, but I prefer what I do." And that's cool. We all have to find our own paths in life.
That's very true, and we're all unique, we're all special, and we all relate to the divine in different ways. And everything that's out there to help you learn about and experience the divine is very helpful, the same way a book on exercises or diet is helpful. But until you've applied it to yourself and seen what works for you to get the results that you want, again, it's, you know, you haven't found your path.
Exactly. Yeah. I just finished another blog today. I mean, most of the stuff that I'm doing is blog writing. There's very little happening. There were rituals and things that I was involved in, but only as a participant leading up to the inauguration and all that. But again, I was just a participant, not running those. But I was very grateful to have been associated with them. So I wrote a blog today. It's basically, it's going right back to the basics. It's on reciprocity and on building a relationship with the gods. So the way I see a relationship being built with the gods would be through prayer and reciprocity. So we talked about Homer before. And it's important to go back to Homer because it's the earliest literary text that we have coming from ancient Greece. It gives us a window into far earlier times, a time of heroes. And the writings of Homer were the closest thing that the ancient Greeks had to a Bible. So they would look through those books, they'd seek out advice, they'd study those his writings, they would memorize them, and they would apply them to various situations. So there's a particular episode at the very beginning of Homer's Iliad, and you've got a prayer for vengeance where you have Chrysis, the high priest of Apollo, calling on vengeance against the Greeks. And so what he says is, "Hear me, O God of the silver bow, that protectest Crecy and holy Cilia and rulest Tenedos with thy might. Hear me, O thou of Smith, if I have ever decked your temple with garlands or burnt your thigh bones to fat of bulls or goats, grant my prayer and let your arrows avenge these, my tears upon the Danans." So the point that he's making is that he has been serving Apollo for many, many years. And it's pretty well the way that we would we'd refer to it as a gratitude type working. So he's been serving Apollo. He hasn't asked for anything in return. But for the ancient Greek mindset, he's a relationship with the gods is based on reciprocity. So as you do things for the gods, you can then expect the gods to do things for you. Mind you, you have to be mindful of the abilities of the god that you're serving. So in this case, he wanted to have plague unleashed upon the Greeks. And Apollo at the time was thought of as a plague god. And referring to his epithet of Smith, that's a reference to him as a mouse god, because even in those days they realized that mice would bring plague, you know, just as the bubonic plague was spread through fleas on rats. So, you know, if you could take care of the rats, you basically take care of the plague. So, and I think that's probably the model that we need to work with. You need to be performing regular devotions to a particular god. And then if you ever need to call for a favor, then you're in a position where you can do so. But again, like I said, it's important to be mindful of the functions of the god. So you can't call on a god to perform a particular function that that god doesn't preside over. One of the things that Socrates would say, he used a very simple formula. He'd say, he'd call on the gods and he'd say, "Give me that which is best for me." So he's actually putting his trust in the gods, that the gods would be able to give him something that was within their power to grant and would be good for him. It was an expression of faith. So I've said before that you can either pray from the heart, as Chrysis did in that particular case, or you can use Homeric hymns or Orphic hymns when addressing the deities. The other things which the ancient Greeks would do is that they would offer a gift or a libation to the deity along with prayer. While blood sacrifices were sometimes offered in ancient Greece, my preference has always been for bloodless offerings. So there were various gifts which were given, so they could either be first fruit offerings or votive offerings. Mm-hmm. First fruit offerings were obtained from agricultural practices or from hunting and gathering, and they'd be set down at a sacred place, after which they were either taken by the poor or animals or dropped into bodies of water or burned. Votive offerings were gifts presented in anticipation of or as a result of divine favor. So a vow would be made in front of witnesses promising a gift in return for a desired outcome, and the gift could be first fruit offerings, an animal sacrifice, a promise to found a new sanctuary, bestowing gifts or slaves unto an existing sanctuary, war booty, primarily weapons, or even locks of hair. But there are other votive offerings that you can give, things like flowers, branches, shells, gold implements, clay images, or offerings. And this is something that I keep referring to. The most widespread offering in ancient Greece was a simple granular frankincense strewn in the flames. So if you just wanted to have the one essential oil or the one incense that you wanted to work with for all the gods, it'd be frankincense. By all means, get other incenses and other essential oils as well. But if you just wanted to have the one, frankincense was the way to go. And we've actually had this discussion.
By the way, with Greeks even today. With Greeks even today, just about every Greek household I know of has charcoal briquettes and frankincense. And then they light candles in the church, beeswax candles. So that's very common. And again, I grew up with that. Everywhere I went, they had the iconostasi, which was like the household shrine. And there were icons and even the old gods in the iconostasi. And then there was, of course, the charcoal briquette with the frankincense.
Back in Sydney, I would go to one of two places to pick up my supplies. One was a supply place for a Greek Orthodox church. So I was able to get hold of the charcoal briquettes in bulk. I could also get livani, which is the Greek word for frankincense. And they also had these infused pellets that had essential oils in them. So you could get things like kedros or cedar. There was jasmine. There were wild flowers. They were absolutely beautiful smelling incenses. And they were gathered by, I think, the monks from Athos, from Mount Athos.
Yes.
They would gather all these incenses together, and I'd be buying these boxes in bulk. And then after I was no longer able to go there, I went to another place, which was a bulk food place for Greeks. And so you'd have all the Greeks in the area going there, buying up bulk olives and feta cheese and whatever else they wanted. But I would go there and buy livani. They would sell it in bulk. And I also buy my charcoal blocks there, because charcoal blocks can be very expensive.
Yes.
But yet you'd go to one of these Greek supply places, they'd sell them to you in bulk, and they wound up being very, very reasonably priced.
That's because for most of our society, that would be something difficult to get. But Greeks use it all the time. So it's like a common thing that Greeks would need or want in great quantities.
Yeah, and whenever they went off to the cemetery, they would always take along their incense and burn that at the graves. It was something that was very, very commonly done. So because they needed huge amounts of this, because every Greek would be burning frankincense, they would offer it extremely cheaply. So I haven't found anything like that here yet. But I will in the end. I'm sure there's a large Greek community here.
Yeah, there must be. Like here in New York, there used to be Astoria, although the demographics in Astoria are changing. My eldest son lives in Astoria still, or he did.
Okay.
He lives near Astoria now. I lived in Astoria for many years as well, and there were tons of Greek shops where you can get those type of things, as well as Greek food and pastries. So there is in most cities, I believe, like a little Greek area or at least a Greek store.
I'm sure there is something. I just haven't found it yet. Most of the stuff in my area tends to be either Asian or Hispanic.
Okay.
There is a huge Armenian community. We actually have an Armenian store in the area. And the funny thing is, it's called John's International Market, and you can buy food, wine, beer from every part of the world except Turkey. it's like their silent protest against the attempt at genocide. But I just find it really cool that you've got all these nationalities going there, knowing that whether they want Polish or Czech or Ukrainian breads or beers or what have you, they will have it in stock. But if you're Turkish, don't bother going in. They're not going to have anything for you.
Yeah, I've told those stories in many shows, so I won't tell it again tonight. But there was a lesson in that. But I grew up with that, being Greek, and The big test, of course, is seeing past that.
Yeah. It's still an ongoing issue that the Turks are still denying what they did, and the Armenians still want justice. I think it's going to be an issue that's going to go on for, you know, at least the next generation, until things finally work themselves out.
Maybe, maybe not. Some of these grudges survive for centuries, if not for millennia. And they continue to play themselves out in our world.
Which is one of the huge arguments against multiculturalism. Because you bring all these people together who've been traditionally enemies, and it doesn't always work.
No, it doesn't always work, but I think that one of the strengths of multiculturalism, and I've taught classes in multiculturalism back in Pennsylvania, is that it is possible to get past those ancient hatreds, as it is possible to break through familial patterns that repeat from generation to generation. And it doesn't come from denying reality. It comes from, you know, letting go of what happened long ago, not being blind to the fact that people are people and it may happen again, but just that perpetuating the conflict is not healthy for you or for anybody else. Have I told the Turkish story to you?
No, I'd love to hear it. Tell me the Turkish story.
Okay, I'm Greek, so I grew up Greek, and I was brought up to hate Turks. And there was a long history of grievances, you know, from before the Ottoman Empire was formed out of the ashes of Byzantium, and subsequently till Greek independence and beyond Greek independence, to what was going on in Cyprus. And, you know, so there was all this hate. And when I was a teenager and very much in warrior mode, I wanted nothing more than to be a Greek soldier and to go to Greece and kill Turks because they were so horrible.
Hmm.
And, you know, they were said to do things like cut open pregnant women and take the babies and bash their brains out in walls. And
oh, yuck.
Old people and to kill young people and to sexually abuse women. And it went on and on and on and on and on. And this was continuous. You know, the outrage, the atrocities was continuous. And when I first started studying theosophy, I was downtown New York a lot. We went to a restaurant one day. I was a channel for a theosophical spiritualist group very early on in my life. There was a Turkish restaurant called Genghis Khan's Bicycle. And at first I was reluctant, you know, to go into a Turkish restaurant, but then I decided to see what that was all about. So the first thing that struck me is that the Turkish people look just like the Greek people that I grew up with. So if I was in a room with random Greek people and the people from Genghis Khan's Bicycle, I wouldn't be able to tell you who was and who wasn't Greek. So that was the first thing that struck me. The second thing that struck me was that a lot of the foods on the menu I was familiar with, and they even sounded the same. So there was kafte and kefte. You know, there were a lot of... And again, there was slight variation in spicing and things like that. But these were all food on their menu that I was familiar with. So once I went there a few times and became a customer, I revealed to them that I was Greek. And, you know, they bristled up and, you know, we had a conversation because, you know, now I was a good customer. So I guess it got past whatever their defenses were. So they told me that they grew up with these stories about Greeks and they really didn't know what Greek people were like. And the stories that they grew up with about Greeks cutting open the bellies of pregnant women and dashing babies' heads against wall and all the atrocities were the same stories that I grew up with pointed toward them.
Wow.
And again, not to deny reality, because there's history, you know, that's been recorded about some of these atrocities. But I saw how, you know, regardless of what happened or didn't happen, you know, back then, that this outrage and this hate had been generated through these stories that I grew up with that were repeated very often, and that they were subjected to the same stories and had the same feelings toward me. And they didn't know me, they didn't know me as a person until I opened the door to that conversation. And if they knew I was Greek, who knows, you know, how I'm sure the interaction would have been polite, because it was a business they were running. And karmically, later on, when I lived in Astoria, when my son was a baby, we were looking for babysitters because my wife at the time and I both worked. And who did we find? The family from Genghis Khan. The same family that owned Genghis Khan's bicycle lived two buildings away from us, and they were looking for some babysitting work. So they raised as babysitters our son while we were working. And they were phenomenal babysitters. Like when they couldn't babysit and we had to find other babysitters, or sometimes when they were away in Turkey and we had to find other babysitters, nobody compared to how they were with our son. And so that allowed me, although I might have grudges against individuals who may be Turkish people, and although I didn't like everything that happened historically, you know, as individuals, I learned to see Turks not as a group of people that I should fear and hate, but as individuals who grew up on the same stories. So that evaporated centuries of that type of ill feeling in me. And being free of that has, you know, liberated me. And I see it happening in our country now, where you have Democrats and Republicans, and we believe horrific things about each other, and we're outraged at the atrocities. But if you speak to individual Trumpists or even QAnon people, because I've had some on the show, they believe the same thing about liberals and Democrats. In fact, the whole QAnon thing is that Democrats are demonic pedophiles.
Yeah.
So they don't see liberals and Democrats as people. They have these hateful stories that aren't the truth. And once you get to the point where it's a group of people, like all men, all women, all Turks, all Greeks, all Republicans, all Democrats, you're no longer in reality. You're in a horrible story.
That's actually how propaganda works, where you dehumanize the group that you're targeting. The Nazis did that with the Jews. They presented them not as human beings, but as something subhuman that had to be wiped out. Once you start realizing that no, they are people. They have feelings. They have aspirations, and all of it. It becomes much harder to exterminate them.
Right.
All the concentration camps ran on this idea of the people who were in there were subhuman.
Because if they're subhuman, even though, you know, people shouldn't abuse any living thing, there's more justification for abusing something in many people's minds that isn't human than there would be if they saw the person there as what they are, a person.
But say, for instance, you look at someone who works in an abattoir. So they're used to slaughtering animals.
Right.
But if you ask them to slaughter people, they probably couldn't do it. But if you convince them that these particular people are subhumans, they're vermin and they should be wiped out, then it'd be much easier to talk him into it.
Right. It's like people make.
But like I said, it's just the way propaganda works.
And we do that. Like, it's okay to slaughter and kill cows, but it wouldn't be okay to slaughter and kill cats, which in some places of the world we do, and dogs, you know. But to us, those are beloved pets, so we can't see slaughtering them for food. But in some places, they can and they do. So we draw these lines rather arbitrarily.
PETA have actually had these advertising campaigns where they'll have a baby calf and they'll have a puppy next to it, and they'll say that you know, one is okay to be slaughtered for food, but the other one's not. The other one is a pet that's supposed to be loved. But there are these videos online that you find people having relationships with a baby calf or a baby pig. They basically raise them to be pets.
Right.
Pigs in particular are incredibly intelligent. They're far more intelligent than dogs. So they would make wonderful pets.
And they do for many people. For a while, it was fashionable to have the miniature pigs as pets.
I didn't know that. Because I keep thinking of the potbelly pigs, and I think that they're really cute when they're little. But once they get to a certain size, it's like, nah, you're going to a sanctuary, buddy.
Yeah, there's a breed of them that stays small, or people believe that they stay small, because I think that most people who get the potbelly pigs believe that they're going to remain little, but they get fairly big.
Yeah, they're huge.
And it's true. I've seen in Greece, I saw where they don't eat a lot of meat. They would occasionally kill a cow or a goat or a sheep, more likely when they get old and they can't produce milk or the other type of things that these animals provide. And there was a farmer who loved his cows. And he always had calves following him around like puppies would. They were huge, but like a dog too. When they got to know you, they'd come and lick you with their sandy tongues, and you know they were very, very friendly, and they frolicked around. And to him they were family. You know, they weren't to be slaughtered.
Every animal I've ever had has been family to me. Mind you, I've only really had dogs and cats. Remember, we had a duck for a while, but it ran off, or flew off, I should say. But I would have liked the opportunity to have had experienced other animals as well.
Well, I looked at the clock. We're at the end of our conversation, and I could talk about this for hours. So we're going to have to get together and do a special just on this, because it really is an important topic. What is, what makes something sentient and something not sentient? I mean, if you can see elementals and devas, and you know that plants suffer when you chop them out of the ground. And there have been experiments showing that if you go in there and tear up a plant, the plants will demonstrate some sort of reaction akin to hostility towards you. If you go back in the room, you know, where you committed this crime against the plant them. So it really is a question that we can't ignore, that we need to look into. And it ties into which of our fellow humans are actually human. As a species, we haven't seen other people as people. Like, there was a lot of confusion. I remember missionaries trying to convert orangutans because they
really
believed. Yes. There was a lot of effort to convert the pagan orangutans. And yet other people who were people weren't seen as people, or they were seen as, in this country, the Native Americans and also the people who were enslaved from Africa, they were seen as fractions of a person legally.
I remember that was a consideration for Christians when the Czechoslovakian Jews created the golem, which is an artificial man.
Yes.
So they basically fashioned this artificial man out of clay, and he was supposed to have protected people who were living in the ghettos. So you had these Christian theologians who were agonizing over this golem, because if the golem had a soul, then they were obliged to minister to it and try to convert it to Christianity. Whereas if it didn't have a soul, they wouldn't have to bother. And just going off on a tangent, I remember a few years ago, the Catholic Church was saying that they were open to the idea of extraterrestrials, but one of their considerations was, well, if the extraterrestrials landed, they would probably have to minister to them and try to convert them to Christianity, which then opens up a can of worms. When Jesus died on the cross, did he die for the sins of this world or did he die for the sins of the universe? I just don't know.
Nor do I, but again, this conversation continues throughout the year, so we can tackle it the next time we schedule a show. We're down
Indeed.
To our last 5 minutes, and I would love for you to share with people how they can access your articles and your books and all the wonderful things that you're doing.
Best way to contact me is through Facebook, either my personal page or my author page. I also have a blog on Pathos called Holistic Spirituality. I'm actually getting much better at writing blogs for it. I would like to do one a week, but usually it's about two a month. So I try to keep it topical. So whenever anything happens that I feel needs to be addressed, I will try to address it. So obviously when we had insurrection, the like, I was uploading articles relevant to that. If you have celebrities coming out of their broom closets, I'll write about that. I try to keep it all topical.
I'm going to ask you questions about that over a personal message, email, or the phone, because I want to go back to doing a monthly column as well. I used to do it on The Magic Happens.
Oh, wow.
I had questions about several other places. I talked to The Magic Happens folks, and they'd welcome me back. And some magazines I used to get published in would also welcome me back. So I'm trying to figure out how I could get on a schedule of writing and publishing at least one thing a month. So I want to explore the Pathos option, because both you and Brandy, people I highly respect, are there.
Yes. I would hold off on Pathos for the next few weeks because they're in a position of flux at the moment. Jason
okay.
Mankey was the guy who was looking after me. He was managing Pathos Pagan, and he has resigned from his position. So he is still cranking out blogs, but he's no longer the manager. So until he's replaced, probably good to sort of sit back and hold off. So consider... They're very flexible. You can write about whatever you want to write about, as long as I suppose it's not too controversial. But then you have to see what sort of audience it's going to expose you to, look at how many people are going to be reading the column, see if it's worth your while. In my case, I do feel it's worth my while to crank out a couple of months. And Brandy's come to the same conclusion. But, you know, we all have to make our own decisions.
Yes, of course. Tony, thank you so very much for an exciting and thoughtful and thought-provoking episode. I'll be thinking about the things we discussed for many hours, and they'll probably form the topic of tonight's meditation before I drift off to sleep. Thank you again so very much.
Thank you. Me too. I'm going to be mulling over your Turkish story. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Be well, and I will talk to you
Same
very
to
soon.
You.
Thanks.
Okay,
and
bye.
Thanks to everybody. Bye-bye. Thanks to everybody who's
bye.
Joined us, whether you're listening live right now or whether you'll be joining us later on demand. This is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. In the minute or so that we have left, we'll play If You Can Dream, which is one of my favorite songs.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be.